This is Leader ReadyCast, a monthly podcast featuring real-world lessons, best practices, and action-oriented insights for the you're-it moments when you're called upon to lead. Leader ReadyCast is the official podcast of the National Preparedness Leadership Initiative, a joint program of the Harvard T.H. Chan School of Public Health and the Center for Public Leadership at the Harvard John F. Kennedy School of Government. Subscribe to Leader ReadyCast wherever you get your favorite podcasts. I'm Eric McNulty, host of Leader ReadyCast. Welcome to our latest episode. Before we jump in, I just want to mention that we have an upcoming seminar online about crisis leadership and artificial intelligence. You can find more details at npli.hsph.harvard.edu. It starts May of this year. Check it out. Now to today's topic. Violent extremism is back in the news as if it ever left. The horrific attack in New Orleans early on January 1st is just one incident that has shown the threats emerging from extremist ideologies. The work of those who seek to counter those ideologies is known as CVE, countering violent extremism. And doing it effectively means going deep into the psychological, cultural, political, and other factors that push someone to the point where they're a danger to others. My guest today is Farah Pandit. She's been working in this area for many years, looking particularly at Islamic State, Al-Qaeda, and other Islamic extremists. She's worked at the Department of State in both the George W. Bush and the Obama administrations. She was the first ever special representative to Muslim communities and traveled to more than 80 countries to understand violent extremism and what can be done about it. Her book, How We Win, is a go-to guide for anyone who wants to better understand these phenomena. Pandit had an appointment at the John F. Kennedy School of Government at Harvard and is currently at Georgetown University on the Council on Foreign Relations. She's also the Muhammad Ali Global Peace Laureate at the Muhammad Ali Center. We'll talk more about that later because that's super interesting. Farah Pandit, welcome to Leader ReadyCast.
Well, hello, Eric, and thank you so much.
It is great to be chatting with you again because you know so much about this topic and it's so important right now. The attack on New Orleans on January 1st shocked everyone. Yet extremist violence has never really gone away since it erupted in 9/11. What's your take on where we are right now?
Well, I want to say to you that when we think about violent extremism, for the most part, Americans are a little bit numb on it because we see violent attacks frequently. We see them in school shootings. We see them in ways that have been quite regular in the United States. And I say that with a very sobering tone. We're not in a place where it's rare anymore. The January 1st attack scared and surprised many, of course. But for those who have been watching the escalation over the last few years of the increase of tactics and the depth with which we are in this, we are not surprised. It's horrific. At every turn, it is horrific. And when you ask, where are we today? We're in a much more dangerous place than we were when 9/11 happened for three really important reasons. The first is the pool from which people are recruiting has grown. We are not just looking at violent extremism that is catalyzed through religion. And in the case of Al-Qaeda and ISIS, they use the religion of Islam for their nefarious ends. But we're also seeing the ideology of extremists expand. So we're seeing Christian nationalists. We're seeing a neo-Nazi ideology. We're seeing anti-trans or anti-LGBTQ as motivating components to ideology. So the pool of people who are triggered and moving in the direction that allows them to eventually take up a gun or a knife to do violence in the name of their ideology has expanded. Secondly, the tools to be able to deal with this, meaning the way in which the government has designed the systems to actually go after the ideology of extremism has not, I know we'll talk more about it, but this is, we're not in a sophisticated place. So it leaves us in a weaker position. And because there's no focus either. I mean, the focus that we went after Al-Qaeda was very sharp and strong. We're not in that place today. And thirdly, and obviously most obviously, is technology over the last 20 years is far more complex and fast and important to this issue of, you know, ideological pull than anything else before. So you take these three factors and you're setting yourself up for an assessment of the landscape today that's far more dangerous than it was in the weeks after 9/11.
That is indeed a sobering assessment, and I agree with you. I think we are in a far more dangerous place and a far more unsettled time than we were then. And one of the things I have to say, frankly, it depresses me when I hear about your approach called by some sort of powerful but little used, and we'll talk more about that, but it's rooted in what we call soft power. So how do we get here? And what are the techniques that are being used now? Why do we keep using techniques that don't work and expecting a different outcome?
Well, let's start with the beginning in terms of what we're talking about here. The soft power angle to fighting these kinds of extremists is dealing with the ideology, the ideological pull that allows somebody to go down a path to find the ideology appealing and becoming so appealing that it becomes their life and so appealing that they are willing to take their own lives for their cause. And so that radicalization process is what we are trying to stop. We're trying to disrupt. The way to do that is through this, you know, the tools in the toolbox of countering violent extremism. And I'm saying that very particularly because the art of soft power in this space is both in an offline place and in an online place. In the offline place, it's how people are actually thinking about themselves and thinking about their identity and how they belong. And they're asking themselves questions about what they stand for, who they are, how they want to represent themselves, what they believe in. And when they're asking those questions, Eric, those are things that are happening in their daily life. Those are things that they are exposed to the world or their community, and they're thinking different thoughts about themselves, which leads us then to the online space. So nothing happens in an online space that doesn't first happen to somebody independently offline. You don't suddenly go into an online chat room or see a Twitter feed and think, aha, I'm hearing something and seeing something I wasn't interested in. No, you're already asking those questions of yourself that you find the content online appealing enough that you might go to the second piece of content and so on and so on. And you then eventually go down a rabbit hole in which you are surrounded by people who think like you, who support your thoughts and motivate you to become more radicalized. And so the tools in the toolbox, the soft power toolbox, are both online and offline for the reasons I've just described. And they require a really bold effort to really think about in the offline space what cultural signals are telling somebody to think a particular way. It means that when we are in a place, let's just use America for an example, when we're in a place where us versus them is consistent, it's everywhere. It's not just about gender or race or sexuality or heritage. It's about everything, politics. It's about who you like and what you do. And our escalation of hate towards the other is really tremendously shocking if you think about it. Look at things like the rise of anti-Semitism. Look at the rise of anti-Asian hate. Look at the rise of anti-Muslim and Arab hate in America over the years. It's not decreased, it's increased. And so the landscape in which people operate in their daily life gives permission for individuals to feel like they can hate another. We don't have guardrails in civil discourse that are shunning people away from that mindset. And in the online space, we have not seen an effort by the US government to get serious about guardrails around hate speech online, about how algorithms are used to be able to push young people, particularly toward horrific content. We've sort of given a pass to the tech companies to be able to self-monitor themselves. And it's this combination that has led us to a situation where the tools that we had in the toolbox right after 9/11, while some of them have increased, we are aware that there are more nonprofit organizations, for example, that are working on fighting hate and extremism. We know that more people are alert to the fact that bad things are happening. But the money, Eric, to go towards building the infrastructure to make this ideology less appealing is very, very minimal. And you cannot fight the bad guys, whoever they are, whether they're neo-Nazis or they're ISIS, if you're just having, you know, a very small effect in the world, because the pace of change, the pace of content is too overwhelming. And that's why we are suffering from bold ideas on how to increase the funding and the people who can be sharp and innovative about what you need to do in the online and offline space. If funding were increased, if the leaders in our country, both in Congress and in the executive branch, were serious about decreasing hate, and if, very importantly, the American public were to become more active and vocal about the need to put guardrails in society that make it less comfortable for bad guys to be able to recruit young people, we would see a very different place than the country we see today.
So I want to know what we should be doing differently at a policy level. But my first question there is, so are we over-reliant on hard power? Because it doesn't seem like we're doing all that well with the sort of hunting them down and hunting people down and preventing things through hard power. Do we just misunderstand soft power or what? I mean, what should we be doing differently?
Well, I'm glad you framed it in that way. Hard power is almost the easier path, because when money is given either by a philanthropy to an NGO to say work on this issue, they want to see metrics. So does Congress. If I give you $10 to work on fighting hate, can you promise me that the thing that you say is going to work will work? No one can promise somebody is not going to get radicalized, but you can fortify in a better way. It is a very different metric and impact scenario than many of the funders think about. So that's one thing that is very important to say. When we think about what needs to be done, one, I would tell you that in the last few years, we have made a judgment and it's not an active judgment, it's not written on paper somewhere, but actions speak louder than words. We've made an assessment that we're going to go after the bad guys through hard power. We're going to go after guns where we can. We're going to put people in jail where we can. We're going to try to fortify overseas through means that are would be described as hard power, so we can break down cells and we can put people away. But in fact, it's not that. If you even talk to the Department of Defense or the Department of State, neither entity would tell you that soft power should not be used in this space. It's the combination of soft and hard power. And it is much easier to go after the ideology with everything that we've got. America is very sophisticated, Eric. When we want to sell you a pair of sneakers, or we want to make sure that you know that some, you know, star has a concert, we know how to get after everybody who's 19 years old to tell them what to do. We know how to do that. We put it in surround sound. We make it appealing to them. We make sure that there's nowhere they can go in society that doesn't know that there is an Eras tour. I mean, you know, it's everywhere, all day, every day. But when it comes to these issues of building a different kind of civil society, a different kind of ethos in America, it's kind of, we've kind of shrugged and said somebody else is in charge of doing that. Well, yes, parents are in charge of making sure their children think differently about the other. Teachers are, society is. It's all of us that have to work together to be able to say we're going to be different about the way in which we look at the other, and we're going to break down the us versus them. We know intuitively that soft power matters. We know that that's the way we would approach, we would prefer that. That approach costs less. It cuts things off before they become bigger and more complex. But the fact of the matter is that even though you may know that soft power is the better way forward, and you know that it's far more creative than hard power, and you know that there is the only thing that will actually influence a young person is the ability to persuade them as their brains are being developed. Even though we have all the data and we know all of this, we are where we are today because it has, no one is in charge of working through a complex series of cultural signals in society that will actually push somebody in a particular way. We're giving the space up to the extremists.
So it seems to me what you're saying is we have the understanding, we have the tools, we have the technology, we know how to do this really well, but we're not, which seems to me we're looking at more a failure of will or misaligned incentive someplace in the system, because everything you've just talked about is something that could be done. It's not like we're waiting for a giant breakthrough.
We are talking about leadership here. This is what we are talking about. How does a leader think about what needs to be done? And I don't want to only throw America under the bus on this. There isn't, I can't tell you that there is, you know, another country in the world who has solved this problem, because people are on cycles of political power. They're leveraging their political moment and how far they want to lean into fighting hate. We have seen, I'm going to use the example of anti-Semitism because it's a really important one. We've seen a 4,000% increase of anti-Semitism over the last couple of years. And it is truly remarkable that we as a society, as Americans, are kind of shrugging and saying, oh, okay, well, that's unfortunate, and give excuses why that's all right. It's not all right. It should not be okay that there are Nazis marching in the streets. It should, and there are literally with swastikas. People should themselves think to themselves, this is not acceptable behavior. When during COVID, people of AAPI heritage were being thrown down on the ground and spit at and hurt, we should, as a society, be saying that is not okay. When somebody who's wearing a turban is screamed at or shot, God forbid, because they look, quote unquote, look Muslim, as Americans, we ought to be saying that is not acceptable. But what we do is we kind of say it's somebody else's problem. There's an NGO that might work on it. There's a, you know, the Department of Homeland Security needs to do that, rather than saying, how can we work together on doing this? And where are the people who are actually advocating for a more compelling and cohesive, you know, surge in fighting hate? There aren't any. We don't have any leaders in this country that are speaking about this. I'm talking about elected leaders. Name some Congress folks that have gotten together across the aisle that have said, we're going to put some serious money into this. Tell me what administration in the last, since 9/11, has really given everything that they have to the work of soft power. Every administration since 9/11 has done something around soft power in fighting extremist ideology, but none of them have gone all in.
Well, I think it's important to note there, this is not a one party or the other party problem. This is a bipartisan problem and failure of bipartisanship in addressing this. So two big things have changed since your book first came out that I think affect both the Islamic extremism as well as the rise of anti-Semitism and some of the other sort of other hate activities you've talked about. One of them is a massive increase in mis and disinformation. I think that affects everything and everyone. The other is the war in Gaza, which I think in particular fuels the hate related to the groups that are involved there. So how do these complicate the situation? And does the tendency to blame Islam writ large, which you see a lot here in the U.S., actually help the extremists?
Well, depending on what extremists you're talking about. So yeah, you're right to talk about the change in the last 5 years since my book came out. Let's talk about mis and disinformation for a moment, and then I'll go to the other component of the question. First of all, when we think about the power of mis and disinformation and the complexity that that brings to bear with people who are unable to see what is real and what is not real, who have not been given the tools to understand, the learnings to understand how to navigate through what could be a real image and what is not a real image. When we look at the advancement of AI being able to amplify that mis and disinformation, when we look at the algorithms that are able to keep feeding a particular person who's using their whatever platform they're using, you know, mis and disinformation, you have a toxic mix at hand. America has not invested in teaching our young people. They're not digitally literate. For example, there is no digital hygiene classes taught in grammar school or in high school, the way they are taught in some parts of Europe. For example, Finland, for example, teaches kindergartners about mis and disinformation. You know, we are seeing an ad hoc way of, there's no kid who's 16 years old who doesn't know there's a thing called mis and disinformation. But to ask a 16-year-old or a 13-year-old to be able to identify what is and what isn't, when you have leading figures in the United States who repost fake content, when you have leaders who are willing to use propaganda that is not real, obviously, and that comes from our adversaries, you're kind of saying to the American public, it's okay, and we're kind of playing this game, not realizing the devastatingly serious implications for the younger generations, in fact, who are getting radicalized. And there are three particular generations that I'm most concerned about. I'm concerned about Gen Alpha, I'm concerned about Gen Z, and I'm concerned about the millennials. Why? Because all three of them are digital natives. They all three are online, you know, too much of the time, by the way. But the platforms from which bad guys are trying to recruit aren't just, you know, Discord and Telegram. They are on the video gaming platforms like Twitch. They're in spaces that parents don't even know that bad guys are trying to recruit. If a human brain doesn't develop until the age of 24, I would hope that parents would be vigilant in making sure that their child understands the digital landscape and is savvy, just the way they teach a 7-year-old or a 13-year-old or whomever it is what to do if a stranger approaches them in an inappropriate way, or if a teacher does something that they're not supposed to do. Well, you have parents who are teaching their children about these kinds of things because that is, of course, the right thing to do. But we're not doing it in the online space. It's somehow okay to pass your phone to a kid who could be getting content that is changing the way they think about the world and themselves. It's unbelievably dangerous. And then you connect that reality to the two things that you just talked about, which is the continual misunderstanding of world religions, first of all, the need to be able to put a religion down or to use a religion as the scapegoat for something more broad. Certainly there are groups that are using Christianity, that are using Hinduism, who are using Islam for recruiting in towards violent ends. That's happening across the world, but we all know that it's not the religion that is doing this. It's the people that are manipulating to be able to force a person who has a cultural affinity toward or a heritage connected to that faith. So that's in the background. And the foreground is this idea of getting after the other. And so when you see a world event, you see the horrific attack by Hamas on Israel on October 7th of 2023, and it's obviously Hamas is a terrorist organization, and in a normal world we would be looking at this and saying, you know, there was a terrorist attack, and everybody would understand that. But with the manipulation of the way in which these events are being framed, dis and misinformation connects to this because it moves people emotionally towards narratives that make excuses for a terrorist attack or give consequences that are different and lead people in a different way. And so I'm very aware of the history of the Middle East and how for the last few decades, the American position has been a two-state solution. But I also know that with such a really important and very front and center topic, it can be a catalyst for others to take it to a different level. And when in the last couple of days, and again, I'm not being political, I'm simply stating fact, with President Trump's decision to state that he believes that America can go in to Gaza and actually can take it over, you know, the immediate assessment by counterterrorism folks was, of course, that groups like ISIS or Hamas or others can use this as a recruiting tool because it inspires emotion and outrage. And those are two components that actually bring people along. And it's obviously not just about groups that use Islam. You see that in the United States with the rise of neo-Nazis, they will use particular content, regular content in the news, to be able to use it as a hook to bring people forward.
So interesting. It really is interesting. But let's get practical here and to bring things down closer to ground level, since multiple administrations have faltered at the federal level. What can leaders do at the local and state level to address this challenge? I mean, is there a grassroots path to combating violent extremism?
The only way you can win in stopping the pool of recruits is to start at the grassroots level in terms of the tools that can be dedicated to teaching kids about all the things we talked about today, but also creating an environment that is different. Leadership has to come from the top, of course, and influencers in a particular community make a difference. A mayor, a pastor, a peer influencer, all of these people are important components of a particular neighborhood, community. And the weakness here is that while we know local matters, that an approach that might be used in Lexington, Massachusetts is not the approach you might use in Orleans, Massachusetts, we do know that it is critical that we have a 24/7 system in place that's going at it full time. And that it's not start and stop. It's not a little trickle here. And tomorrow you're going to have a lecture on fighting hate and why that's bad. And then wait 3 months and, you know, somebody's going to do something else. That's not the way it works. If you want people to move emotionally and to learn about things, it's got to be in your face 24/7 with a multitude of different things, a little, you know, smart, being smart about this in terms of the narratives that you're putting forward. I talk about it from the cultural perspective because it's all the cultural touch points that you see. When you begin to think about how American societies are moving one way or another, what is cool, what is not cool, it's not because they've only listened to a podcast and they heard something and then they're going to change their life forever. It has to be reinforced by lots of different signals in society, cultural signals that come from a wide variety of places. And so are there tools available? Yes, but you've got to get local leaders, parents, teachers, mayors, influencers, pastors, whoever is in the community to say, this is an effort we're really going to do. And one way to think about it is, if you were to try to get a town to suddenly change the way they think about recycling, you wouldn't just have one barrel, you know, on some street somewhere that says, please recycle here. They would be everywhere. You would see signs all the time. There'd be ads on the radio. There would be television shows that were embedded with the themes of why it's cool. You'd get you'd be creative about how you were teaching your community to do that. It's the same kind of thing in terms of fighting hate. The moment you say it's okay to be hateful toward the Jew or the Muslim or the Hindu or the person who is a trans person or somebody who is, came to this country 3 years ago, or somebody that, has a disability. The minute you say that's okay is the minute you give permission for society to move in the direction that we don't want it to move.
It's so interesting you say that, because again, we know this. I was looking up for the movie Wicked, which came out recently. There were more than 400 promotional tie-ins, so different ways they were trying to surround the message of Wicked is cool, go see this movie, and everything from candy bars to clothing to whatever. And for some reason, this escapes us when we get to something as serious as CVE that we. Again, we know how to do this. Maybe we just ought to call up the brands people instead of the
But they thought,
policymakers.
and Eric, this is such a great point. That's a great point on Wicked. It was candy, it was drinks, it was the tie-in to the commercial aspects. Business matters here. Fighting hate is not for only government or for some local nonprofit who has to raise their money to do this. Business needs to get a grip also. And the subtitle of my book talks about this too. I get that business might think that this is not their thing, but fighting hate is everybody's thing because what happens outside of the walls of your business impacts inside. There's a reason why, by the way, some of the Silicon Valley companies have anti-caste policies. Why do you think that is? Because things that are happening externally are impacting the bottom line for the companies internally. Their actual people who work in those companies don't feel safe. So there is a bottom line for business to get with the program. And the money that Wicked spent, I would love to know what that number is to do it in surround sound all day, every day. That is just, I mean, you can imagine it's just a fraction, a teeny tiny fraction that's spent on fighting hate because it's somebody else's problem. They don't want to put the money in. And I know this firsthand because when after 9/11, when I went to businesses, by the way, to say you have a role in this, they kind of said, well, this is terrorism or this is something scary, and we don't want our company connected to this very scary thing. People need to get a grip. This is not, fighting hate is scary. It's scary because it's all around us now. It is in surround sound, and it's going to get worse. We're not seeing a de-escalation of anti-Semitism in America. We're seeing an escalation of it. When you talk to Arabs and Muslims today in our country, they're talking about the plan to figure out where they're going to go if things get worse. When you talk about to Hispanics or people who are minorities in our country, for whatever reasons, they are seeing the rise of anti whatever it is in their faces and they're scared. So for me, as I look at this problem and I know that the solution set is available right now, it's also affordable. It's a fraction of the cost that we spend on hard power. I see a path to success if we were to go all in.
Wow, that's a lot. Well, let's. I want to turn to something hopefully that's a little bit more upbeat as we come to a close here. Tell us more about your work at the Muhammad Ali Center. I mean, being a global peace laureate sounds pretty cool. What's that all about?
It has been an exciting and amazing journey over the last couple of years to be the Muhammad Ali Global Peace Laureate. And one of the things that I'm most proud of has been the opportunity to work with the Ali Center on an index on compassion, which was launched in January of 2025. This index measures compassion in 12 American cities using artificial and human intelligence. It's all the things that we've just talked about on this podcast. How do we think about compassion in our cities? And one of the reasons that we use that word is because obviously Muhammad Ali was not only an incredible athlete, he was also a humanitarian that used compassion in his work. And what we want to say to communities is there is a way for you to build compassion into your cities. And so this index isn't just about where a city lands in on the scale of who's most compassionate or who is not. It is about why a particular city is more compassionate to another. And since we can figure out what things are actually in a city that allows compassion to rise, we want to motivate other cities and other communities to do that too. So you can go to the Ali Center website and see the index on compassion. And I urge your listeners to take a look and see how we measured compassion in America. It is one of the most eye-opening indices and pieces of data that I've seen in a very long time. But it's also hopeful because there are ways to build more compassion in a society. And this won't come as a surprise to you, Eric, but ways to do that are including the way in which you use sports actually as a tool, or in fact, how you think about health in your community. Those are the most robust answers to the compassion piece. How to build compassion around things like that. And I'm very proud of the work that the center has done in creating this index on compassion. And I think it's going to be the motivation factor for a lot of cities across our country.
Well, that sounds like a great antidote to the overwhelming negative news we get every day. So listeners, it is a good thing to go check out that compassion index and see how your city or a city near you ranks and what the ways are that you can increase compassion in your community. So Farah, my final question for you is the same one I ask each one of my guests. What gives you hope?
We are in February of 2025 and the world feels like it is literally on fire, but it also feels overwhelming. There's a lot going on. But what gives me hope is the fact that I know that one person has an opportunity to make a difference in their communities. And I look at that as a first step into change. If you think about all of the problems, you feel like you're boiling the ocean and that there's no way you can get to the other side. But if you think about things in terms of smaller steps, nano interventions, micro interventions, macro interventions that you can make, it can build towards something that will see change in a real way. I know that firsthand. I've seen it firsthand. And I know so many individuals across our nation want to see a better future. And I urge us all to think about how we as an individual can do one act, something to make a difference.
Well, that's something that gives me hope as well. So thank you so much. My guest for this episode has been Farah Pandith. She's, I think, given us great insights into the world of violent extremism and, more importantly, what to do about it. You can find out more about her work on CVE at farahpandith.com. And until next time, be ready for the You're It moment when you're called to lead. And don't forget to check out our Crisis Leadership and AI workshop coming up online starting in May. You can find more details at npli.hsph.harvard.edu.
This has been another episode of Leader ReadyCast from the National Preparedness Leadership Initiative. Subscribe to Leader ReadyCast wherever you get your favorite podcasts. And find out more about us at npli.sph.harvard.edu. Follow us on Twitter @HarvardNPLI. Thanks for listening and be ready to lead.